War is hell, and what our soldiers went through was definitely that. In a moment, we are going to be talking about haunted World War II. Matthew Swain back with us, and that story is next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. Matthew Swain with us, a journalist who currently works as a research writer at Penn State. Matt has also worked as a reporter for several newspapers and online outlets. He's a regular contributor to the recently revitalized version of Omni magazine called Omni Reboot, and he writes the Antimatter column, which looks at fringe science and the paranormal, for the online magazine. He uses his experience in journalism and his interest in both ghost lore and the paranormal to collect and tell stories all about the supernatural. He was with us a couple months ago with Richard Serrett, talking about some haunted rock and roll. That was a classic, Matt. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me on.
Varied background. How does a journalist get involved in the unusual and the paranormal?
Well, the simple answer was I was born that way. I was born on Halloween.
Oh, were you?
Yeah.
Well, happy birthday coming up.
Yeah, thank you very much. So that really kind of started my interest in it. I don't ever remember a time where I wasn't interested in ghost stories, horror movies, and the like. So I just learned, I never really wrote about it until I started to work as a reporter. And every Halloween, I would try to write a feature story, a Halloween feature story. And so I started to write a story about local ghost legends around the area where I was born. And the reaction to that story was so overwhelming that I thought, well, there's really something here. And so since then, I've combined my interest in history and folklore and ghost stories and just kind of combined them all together.
Did your birthday cut into Halloween, or did Halloween cut into your birthday when you were a kid?
No, it sort of made my birthday exponential. I like to refer to it as the season of Matt now.
I love it. Kicking off the year, I love this quarter. October, yeah. November, December, it is the best.
Absolutely.
And how did you get your interest in World War II?
Well, I wrote three books about music and the supernatural. And at a certain point, I wanted to find another project to place with my publisher. And initially, I thought, I'm to be completely transparent, I consider myself more of a Civil War geek. But I started to look around at writing a Civil War book. But what I found is that there's just so much good stuff out there already, and that people have compiled numerous books. So I didn't think I could really add anything to that area of ghost stories and the supernatural. So I turned towards World War II and started to research whether there were any ghost stories. And sure enough, there were plenty of ghost stories that I could compile in a way that I like to do it. I like to couple ghost stories with, tales of synchronicities and Fortean tales. So Haunted World War II, it turned into be just a really deep area for me to explore. And that's kind of what I like to do.
And in Haunted World War II, were these ghost stories and events from World War I that overlapped into World War II, or were these things happening during the Second War?
So most of the stories that I compile are stories from World War II, not between the wars.
Okay.
And they continue to occur, believe it or not.
What creates the difference between these kinds of ghost stories, I would call them military hauntings, as opposed to regular kinds?
That's a great question, because, most of the stories that I wrote about before, university ghost stories, haunted rock and roll, ghost stories of country music, there's sort of a lighthearted aspect of those stories compared to what I found myself into when I started to research the World War II ghost lore. And I think when you're dealing with war and warriors and victims of atrocities, and World War II probably set a new standard in violence and atrocities. So there is a deep seriousness about the material, and I really want to honor the sacrifices, especially from the soldiers and sailors and Marines. you know, when you're dealing with this, these acts of valor on Normandy and, you know, all of those stories, you want to make sure that you're honoring what they brought. The other thing that I found a little different when I started to research Haunted World War II was that, you know, you want to make sure that you get the history right. History serves as a backdrop for a lot of these stories. And I think ghost stories are one way that people help preserve the past, but sometimes they're not perfect in the history. So what I found myself doing is a lot of times is finding these ghost stories and then trying to confirm to make sure that history was correct. You know, I've never looked for whether a Schmeisser was available to German troops in during the Normandy invasion, but you know, I found myself looking at those types of details. So I think those are two reasons why these stories are a lot different from the stories that I worked on before.
What is it, Matthew, about the battlefield that seems to enhance these stories? And they could be anywhere. They could be. I had a friend who just went to the Little Bighorn, where Custer's last stand was. And, you know, he's convinced that's haunted, too. Gettysburg, we know, is haunted.
Right,
and I'm sure
right.
There are other battlefields that are. But what is it about war that creates these hauntings? Is it because, sadly enough, these soldiers die so suddenly and they just still hang around? What's going on there?
Yeah, there are a lot of theories about why battlefields seem to attract these hauntings more so than other places. And there essentially is two camps on this. So you have, on one hand, you have the paranormal theorists. And they say that this, in one case, they say that this violence and trauma of war causes these, the event almost embeds itself in time and space, and it gets repeated over and over. So that kind of explains what they would consider residual hauntings. Now, on the other hand, there are some theorists that also say that, you know, the shock of war happens so quick that maybe people have a hard time transitioning. Maybe their spirits have a hard time transitioning from one plane to the next. That's the other theory. Now, there's a whole skeptical side of this, too. And what these skeptics would suggest is that because these areas are profoundly moving emotionally, when you talk about the sacrifice, when you talk about the death and the tragedy, that it raises your consciousness that maybe you mistake normal activity, normal phenomena, for paranormal phenomena. So those seem to be the main theories behind why these battlefields are so haunted.
Is there a specific battlefield that you would say is the most haunted of all?
I think consensus-wise, I would say Normandy is extremely haunted. There's just dozens of stories, especially, and it might be because there are a lot of tourists that are visiting that area, and so a lot of those tourists are documenting what happens, but the bunkers, the fortifications seem to be haunted. One of the stories that I found particularly interesting was that a father and daughter visited the battlefield.
And that's part of France, for people who don't know where it is.
Right, yeah, Normandy, France. The father and the daughter visited the Normandy beaches and were exploring some of the fortifications and went into a bunker. And when the daughter and father said that when they came out of the bunker, they didn't really talk too much about it, but then later the daughter said that when she was in there, she saw these figures, these people actually, in the bunker. Some were laying down, some were looking out the window, and then she started to describe their uniforms, and the father, who was a World War II buff, immediately recognized these uniforms as German uniforms. And later, he decided he wouldn't press the issue on her right away.
Mm-hmm.
But then later, he talks to her, and he brought out a book of weaponry and uniforms, and then asked her to look through it and identify what she saw. And he claims that she had no access to any World War II history books. He tried to keep that away from her because she was so young. But then she began to describe the guns that were there, the uniforms that were there, and they all matched what could have been in that bunker at that time. So you do have stories like that from pretty credible sources that they've had these experiences in Normandy. And that certainly wasn't the only one that happened in those bunkers. The other place that I talked to a German ghost hunter, and his name's Tom Padal, and he told me that he investigated the Ardennes battlefield, which is in Germany or near Germany, and site of the Battle of the Bulge. And he claims to have encountered a lot of weird activity there, and he considers that area one of the most haunted places in Europe. He also said that the concentration camps are extremely haunted, but out of honor and respect for those, the dead there, he refuses to investigate. He's just heard a lot of stories. And likewise, I decided to leave any stories about the concentration camps hauntings out of my book, too.
Yeah, that's too emotional, isn't it?
Yeah, too much.
It really is. What would you say are some of the most dramatic stories that you've put in the book?
Some of the most dramatic stories.
I mean, every chapter's riveting, I got to say.
Oh, I appreciate that. The ones that moved me the most, I found, were the stories that happened in the Pacific Theater. And again, when you're talking about World War II, you're talking about a global conflict. So these ghost stories crop up literally everywhere.
Yeah.
In Okinawa, that was the one story that stood out for me. And there's a story about a group of civilians who committed suicide en masse right after the American invasion of Okinawa.
And just a little like Heaven's Gate or something like that. Huh?
Well, it wasn't exactly like that. The story is that the Japanese military knew that Okinawa was kind of the last fortress they had in the Pacific. If the Americans took over Okinawa, they would build an air base, and that air base would bring most of Japan easily into the range of their of the American bombers. So what the Japanese did was they spread stories to the civilians that if the Americans invaded, they would torture, kill, and, you know, God knows what else, the civilians, enslave them.
Scared the living daylights out of them, I guess.
Right, absolutely terrified. So when the Americans did invade, the civilians would run off the cliffs and commit suicide. And that's, you know, that's a documented piece of history. Just a terrifying story. But now, there are stories, one story in particular that I wrote about in the book is that a group of tourists were at a peace museum near those cliffs, and they were walking in a field near that museum, and they heard the sound of what they considered, they said it was almost like a herd of footsteps coming their way, and they couldn't see anything. And then they felt a wind pass them, and then later heard what they described as cries and screams. So that was pretty moving for me. Another story from the Pacific, Iwo Jima, is equally heartbreaking. And Iwo Jima, there are literally thousands of Japanese soldiers that were probably buried alive because they were buried in in a tunnel system, a very intricate tunnel system under the island, and the entrances caved in, or the soldiers were actually burned alive in the tunnels. So there's a story that I write about that one Japanese civilian worker claims that every time he gets a call that he has to return to the mainland, and he gets a knock on the door, and he claims that's these spirits of these soldiers on Iwo Jima that want to be repatriated back to the mainland of Japan. So those are some pretty intense stories that crop up, and they're certainly not rare in this volume, at least.
What's interesting too, Matt, is that they seem to be so prevalent all over the place. Something's going on.
Yeah, that's true. And not only are they everywhere, the different, one of the the amazing aspects of the World War II supernatural is that the ghosts don't even necessarily have to be people, because there's actually ghost planes that appear, especially over England.
Almost like the Flying Dutchman, the ship.
Yeah, absolutely, exactly.
People see these planes and they're really not there?
Yeah, this is, and I'll tell you a little story from my own family background.
Did they hear them too?
Well, some do and some don't, but there's one area in the United Kingdom, it's a northern section of the UK called Derbyshire, and it's known as the Bermuda Triangle of the UK. It sounds pretty pastoral sounding, so I don't know why there's such activity, but there have been a lot of plane crashes there. About 50 planes, I think, have crashed in that area, and it has quite a reputation. But over the years, there have been what they call ghost plane flaps. So, for example, in 1985, a bunch of people claimed to have seen this huge military aircraft flying overhead. One couple was driving down the highway, and they saw this very low-flying bomber cruising over the highway, and they said that it didn't have any sound whatsoever, which was remarkable because it was so big, and you know, I think they described it as a four-prop engine, and it looked like a World War II bomber. So, of course, skeptics believe that it was probably, you know, either a current military plane or possibly a maybe a bomber going to an air show or something like that. That was what
what they thought, yeah.
Right. But to counter that, a lot of these people that saw this, first of all, there didn't seem to be a pattern of flight with this. There didn't seem to be a straight line as you might see with a regular, conventional, non-spooky aircraft. This appeared in different areas throughout that region. And a couple of the people that spotted this, one in particular, worked for an airfield during World War II. Was a flight mechanic for the RAF. So definitely would have known the difference between, let's say, a modern, I guess, like a Hercules aircraft, and something like a B-24 or a Lancaster bomber. And this person described it either as a Lancaster or as a B-24 bomber. So pretty peculiar. And there have been other what they call ghost plane flaps throughout history. And I think there was even one as I was writing this book, so 2017. Pretty interesting.
Matthew, did they describe how the planes would disappear? How they would leave?
The one couple just said that it flew overhead and they thought it was going to crash. And I believe they pulled over to see if it did crash, or at least to hear it. And it just kind of disappeared.
Just poof, like that.
Yeah.
Like it wanted to do a different time warp or something?
Right. And the reason I looked into these ghost plane stories is when I was young, my parents woke up early one morning. It was a sort of a misty, foggy morning, and they went for their morning walk. And my parents came back and said that as they were starting their walk, they saw an absolutely huge aircraft coming down just a few hundred feet off the ground, and it was very foggy, didn't make a sound, went overhead, and then just kind of disappeared into the mist.
That would be eerie.
My mom was still telling that story over and over, and that's what made me think, well, England was just a huge aircraft carrier back in World War II. I wondered whether they had any stories similar, and sure enough, it's not that it happens all the time, but it's certainly a rather common occurrence for these ghost planes to be seen.
I bet they had hundreds of them. We're going to come back and talk more about haunted World War II. Next hour, you'll share your questions and stories with us. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Matthew Swain with us. His website is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. A couple of his other books, Haunted Rock and Roll, Ghosts of Country Music, More Haunted Rock and Roll. We'll talk a little bit about that tonight as well. But tonight, right now, we're talking about his latest, Haunted World War II, Soldier Spirits, Ghost Planes, and Strange Synchronicities. Pearl Harbor, is it haunted or not?
It's extremely haunted, according to a lot of the people that go there. And many of the people, tourists, people who are interested in history go there, will talk about the feelings they have when they're touring Pearl Harbor, especially the USS Arizona Memorial, which is essentially a tomb, a mass grave. And it'll tell you what a moving experience is. And again, we think about that idea that somehow the power of that event has etched itself into the time and space around Pearl Harbor. And the ghost stories that have been told about that famous area are pretty extensive. There's one story of a sailor who apparently left his watch on the USS Arizona just briefly, and then during that time where he left the ship, it was attacked and sunk. And now there's this story of this forlorn-looking sailor standing at the edge of the memorial, kind of looking out into the bay where the Arizona now rests. So that ghost story has been told quite a bit. excuse me.
Sure.
There's also a story of one lady who took a picture just of the memorial, and of course the waves in the memorial. And then when she looked at it, there seemed to be faces in the picture. Very and that went on online throughout. And not only is the area of Pearl Harbor, the harbor itself, haunted, but there have been ghost stories at places like the Schofield Barracks and Hickam Air Base, areas that were part of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. And one place in particular in Hickam, there was a headquarters building that supposedly served as a morgue after the attack and had some 200, 300 bodies in it. And the place is so haunted, they said that they moved the CQ desk, which is usually inside the building. They now say they post the guards outside of the building because of all the complaints that the soldiers had of this ghostly activity, the sound of people running up and down steps to such a degree that the staircase itself would shake. So it's a pretty haunted place.
The Desert Fox, Rommel, the Nazi Panzer tank leader, had some incredible things happen to him too. He died in 1944.
Mm-hmm.
But what does he still haunt?
Well, that's probably the most interesting story that I found when I started to research this book, because I did initially look to see if I could find the ghosts of a lot of famous generals, Patton, Eisenhower, as well as some of the Axis powers. And Erwin Rommel has always been a kind of a subject of fascination for me. So I started to, you know, try to find if there were any ghost stories about him. I thought he might be found in North Africa, which is where he gained much of his fame as the Desert Fox. Maybe on the shores of Normandy, he would be among those many ghosts that appear in Normandy. He was really behind the architecture, the development of the fortifications there, and the constructions of the defenses along what was considered their Atlantic Wall. Or maybe he would be in Germany. But I actually found ghost stories about Rommel in the United States, believe it or not. So one of the places is Mount Hebron Cemetery in Winchester, Virginia. People claim to see this figure, long trench coat, a cap on, looking over the graves. And there are some people who say that he is actually at the graves. He's seen at the graves of some of Patton's, General Patton's ancestors. And then there's an inn in West Virginia where they claim that Rommel haunts. So what's the story behind that? There is a story that between the wars, Rommel, along with a few other German generals, traveled on a secret trip to America to visit some of the battlefields of the Civil War, particularly they were looking at the way that Stonewall Jackson maneuvered through the Shenandoah Valley. So this is why this story that Erwin Rommel haunts these areas is around today. They think that he has left his spirit here because he once visited those sites. Now, is there any historical basis for this? I haven't been able to find any, and most historians will tell you that it never happened, that the German generals never came here. People who believe these stories say it was a secret mission, and therefore there would be no historic record.
Exactly.
So that was kind of the interesting one for me.
And what about other World War II infamous people? Do they still show up, haunt?
Well, there's some really interesting stories for me. There's one that Churchill still haunts a subway in London that once served as kind of a temporary bomb shelter, and people have seen his spirit there. I found the story that Churchill actually witnessed the ghost of Abraham Lincoln in World War II to be fascinating. He said that he, and I hate to lay this imagery on your listeners, but according to Churchill, he had stepped out of the bathroom completely naked in what's now called the Lincoln bedroom of the White House. And he had traveled to the White House on several occasions to visit with FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, as well as other officials from the American side. He steps out of the bathroom, and there's Abraham Lincoln leaning against the mantle. And I think Churchill says something like, when Lincoln turns to face him, Churchill says something like, I see you've caught me at a disadvantage, Mr. President. And then Lincoln fades away. So that was kind of a...
Lincoln probably faded away quickly.
Yes, I would have got out there as fast as I could. Lincoln has gone through enough. He didn't need to witness
that. No, not a nude Winston Churchill.
He didn't need that. So there's some other stories about Eisenhower. He haunts what's called the Bullet, which is a train that's on display at the National Railroad Museum. I think that's in Green Bay, Wisconsin. We talked a little bit about the ghosts of Gettysburg, and apparently he and Mamie may be behind some of the hauntings in the farmhouse that they used to own there. So, yeah, there's a lot of famous ghost stories from some of the bigger leaders of the most famous leaders of World War II.
And do these continue, these hauntings?
Yeah, they do, as a matter of fact. You know, the Bullet, I believe the story that some of the stories that I found out about that were from the 1990s, the 2000s. One story is that a custodian who was vacuuming the carpet in the Bullet was halfway finished and decided to take a break, left, locked the door of the train, and went to lunch or have a snack. And then when he came back, someone had completed the vacuuming, and he could tell because the lines of the vacuum cleaner were super straight up and down. And according to some of the people who knew Eisenhower, he was very meticulous, and that's how he insisted on having the Bullet cleaned. So that story probably not too long ago. And, you know, as we talked about the ghost plane flap, they're happening probably even as we speak.
Back in World War II, there were actual reports of UFOs. They called them Foo Fighters. They were small, little disc-type objects flying all over the place that pilots reported seeing. Did you come across anything like that?
Yeah, I actually did a whole section on it because they were so prevalent, as you point out. And based on my research and my reading about that, essentially the whole modern UFO era starts in World War II with some of these sightings of these strange lights and objects that the American flyers used to just call Foo Fighters. And what stands out about these reports for me is just the quality of the observers, because most of the people who witnessed these Foo Fighters were trained pilots, and their ability to recognize these aircraft shapes and the capabilities of those aircraft is literally a life and death decision. So when they tell you they see something out of the norm in the air, then I take that very seriously. And some of these pilots were trained bomber pilots, fighter pilots for a night fighting squadron were documented some of the most startling run-ins with these UFOs. There's a story of a lone B-17 crew that watched a UFO track them for miles, I think almost about an hour. And then, of course, a lot of people consider what's known as the Battle of Los Angeles was a
great story.
UFOs. Yeah, that's an amazing story. And usually, I think the movie 1941 with John Belushi. They made it seem like it was just based on what the War Department called war nerves. In other words, this was shortly after World War II, I think, after the bombing of Pearl Harbor. I believe it was in February of 1942. And anti-aircraft gunners started firing in the air. There was all kinds of pandemonium. And the War Department just said the people were nervous. But I found an account from a very good witness who actually was a professor at Occidental College later. He was just a kid at the time. And he said that what he witnessed was a huge object that was pretty much just standing, setting still in the middle of the, right above the ocean, that these guns were trained right on it, and it didn't seem to have any effect. And then it drifted. It almost sounded like it drifted right over his head. So it was, to me, that was more of a story about something weird happening in the sky, let alone war nerves.
Well, and they shot against it, Matthew. People could hear pinging sounds.
Yeah.
They were hitting something.
Right. This person actually said some of the shells were landing a few feet away from them, and they had the spotlight trained on it. I think there's a pretty dramatic picture that shows that.
It is dramatic. Matthew Swain with us, his latest book, Haunted World War II. Where do you get the book, Matthew?
You can get it at Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com. Go to your local bookstore and see if they have it in. If they don't, shake them down and try to get it in for me. I'd appreciate it.
What about haunted ships from World War II?
Well, I didn't want to leave our sailors out.
No, there, so 9 years Navy for me, so let's not leave us out.
Okay, well, yeah, I'm going to make sure I have those in there. So the interesting thing about after World War II is you had these battleships, you had aircraft carriers, and they were engaged in so many activities, so much honor that those sailors served in, that it was a shame to just scuttle them or to reduce them to scrap. But luckily for us, a lot of people got into preserving those ships, those aircraft carriers and those battleships, as living museums. And they brought them back to different ports. And also, when they brought them back to these ports, they brought a lot of ghost stories with them. And some of the ones that I collected, the USS Yorktown, which is now in Charleston Harbor, there's a lot of activity witnessed there. A shadow figure is probably one of the ones. They call him Shadow Ed, and Ed stands for enemy designated, which was a World War II term for when you come in contact with the enemy. There's some pretty dramatic stories of ghost hunters chasing this shadow creature around the carrier. The USS Hornet, I think, is probably one of the most documented ship-based haunted sites. There is a story about a man dressed in a white naval uniform who wanders around the deck. Some of the battleships, the USS North Carolina. I worked with a few paranormal investigators from Port City Paranormal, and they basically told me they have a career documenting the hauntings on there. And of course, we mentioned USS Arizona. All of those, There are a lot more. I was finding them even as I was starting to publish this book. So, yeah, a lot of World War II ships are haunted, and I'm just glad that they preserved them and have them back here, ghosts and all.
Just an amazing series of events that have been happening that seem to all have a similarity, and that has to do with tragedy. For some reason, tragedy makes these ghosts, or whatever we want to call them, hang around. Don't you think?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. That seems to be the one common element of, you know, I'll say not just the ghosts of World War II, but when you talk about haunted rock and roll, which I investigated, and even some of the ghost stories of country, these tragedies just seem to linger. It's like either the spirit doesn't want to let go, somehow this is a interaction between consciousness and reality, or maybe that we're just so primed to when we hear these tragedies, to maybe hope that the spirits go on or the spirits linger. There's probably a lot of different reasons for that. Those are just some of the ones that I've come across.
Our special guest, of course, is Matthew Swain. We're going to take calls next hour with him, stories and questions, of course. And let's get into, when we come back also after the break, Matthew, a little bit of your haunted rock and roll stories. Those are fantastic, too.
I love them. That's one of my favorites.
They just keep coming more and more and more. They just never stop. Like, you know, people like Michael Jackson, who have passed on now, and Prince and folks like that. Have they come back yet as a ghost?
Well, there are definitely ghost stories about Michael Jackson. There were a few video anomalies when I believe his brother, I believe it might have been Jermaine, was being interviewed. People said they saw Michael Jackson walk behind him. There are stories from neighbors of a former home owned by Michael Jackson who claimed to hear music coming out of it at odd times when there shouldn't be anybody at home. So definitely Michael Jackson ghosts have been seen. There are starting right now a lot more ghost stories about Prince, who just died. I think back in 2016, his Paisley Park, his recording studio, several of the workers there claim to hear people shuffling around. They hear voices. Fans have also blogged about how they believe like they've had an encounter with the ghost of Prince.
Yeah, they seem to be everywhere. We'll come back. We'll talk more about some of these haunted rock and roll stories and take some calls next on Coast to Coast AM.